Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Hello, everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Welcome to this live episode. So glad to be back here at home in the studio. It was a crazy few weeks on the road. As one of my friends put it on the internet, we were literally shot out of a cannon on the third and on the road for almost 3 weeks straight. So it was wild. Got to zoom past the Palisade fires in airplanes, things like that. God bless all those people out there, our good friends, our good research buddies, folks like Earl Grey Anderson, so many others, Daniel Hariri, all kinds of folks, Kevin Jeffers out there in the West Coast in California. God bless to all you guys that have been displaced by that. Hope that everything is working out well for all of you. In the meantime, it is actively snowing here in Austin, so hell has frozen over. It's not often that we see snow here in the Lone Star State, much less snow that hits the ground, sticks to the ground, and actively stays. So the kid got to go out, throw a few snowballs. It was fun. It's a great start to the new year. And, you know, all told, everything is going fantastically, but we did just have the inauguration and MLK Day yesterday. I think a lot of people were expecting other things to pop off in the world. Thank God nothing did, but it's one of those we have chances for different things. We'll see what happens. We'll see what comes of it. You know, I always hold out hope for humanity on this show. That is kind of our mantra forever and always, is that we are an intelligent species. We figure our way out of all kinds of things, the same way that we figured our way into them. So I hold hope for us that we will find new paths, new ways of bringing our communities back together, despite all of these things. Speaking of communities, I want to thank our good friend Michelle Freed, who is now out there in our chat forum during our live stream. She is our new moderator. Welcome, Michelle, to the community. It's been fantastic having you there, doing this for us. It's been great. It's awesome having somebody there to be able to keep chats going, all that kind of stuff, keep the ideas flowing amongst the audience. And our guest tonight, in the second part, we're going to be having some fun with our good friend, Dr. Richard B. Spence. He is a professor emeritus. He's now retired, but lifetime professor at University of Idaho, specifically in the world of American-Russo spy relations. And he has beautiful series on what's now Wondrium, also called The Great Courses on Amazon. And he just did a great one on secret societies throughout time. And when I saw him again, I was like, man, it's been too long. So I contacted him. In the second part, we'll be talking about the Illuminati, the actual Bavarian Illuminati, how it began, how it started, how it begat the literal conspiracy theories that are out there now, the idea that media is owned by the Illuminati, that, you know, rock and roll is run by the Illuminati, that pop music is, you know, just it's fascinating to see how an actual society that existed has moved this way in a Rubik's Cube fashion throughout humanity. And is the Illuminati still there? So we'll be talking about that with Richard B. Spence in the second part of the episode. In the first part, speaking of a long time, we were just chatting pre-show with Rob Guttrow, our guest in this first segment, about It's been a long time since he's been on, so we will be welcoming back Rob Gutro to start a conversation about spirit animals and then talk about his new book that is coming, or that has just come out, which is The Haunting of Emery Estate. So welcome back to the show, Rob Gutro. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be back.
Absolutely, man. It's great to have you back. I have seen quite a few people very interested in tonight's first topic, the idea of animal spirits. And it's one that, you know, is fascinating to me because I am firmly of the mind that spirituality and science do not have to bump heads. They don't have to get in the way of each other. The fact that we are beings of frequency to begin with, you know, anything that has a beating heart is literally just a being of frequency. So when you vibrate one octave higher, the physical particle goes away and you just go into another realm of vibration, you know, like that. That's just physics to me. But it's strange how many people, especially in religious circles, things like that. Once again, growing up Roman Catholic, spending time as a Catholic seminarian, that was something that was hotly debated over beers and philosophy and, you know, things like that. Not just how many angels could dance on the head of a pin, but does your furry friend have a soul, you know? Things like that, like what happens to the soul. And I think that a lot of things get thrown in catch-all bins, Rob, whether it comes to religion and spirituality or even when it comes to the idea of ghost and spirit, you know, and I think that's a perfect place to really launch off on this conversation is you as a medium. How do you see the difference between ghost and spirit? Is there a difference between a ghost and a spirit?
Yeah, sure. So that was actually the foundation of my first book, because I started having experiences when I was 13, and my grandfather appeared to me after he passed. And then I encountered a ghost in a home that I lived in when I was in college. And I knew that I realized that there were differences. As I grew older, as I developed my abilities, I also realized that there are differences and similarities. And sure. What I've learned is that you talked about the soul, and the soul is memories, personality, and knowledge combined with the energy that comes from within us, the physical energies. And I found that what happens after we die is that we make a choice. We choose to either cross over into the light, and that's what I call a spirit, or we stay earthbound at a fixed location of our choosing, or where we died, like a hospital or prison or battlefield or something like that. Or, and that's what I call a ghost.
Sure.
So there are similarities in the use of energies, physical energies. They all use the same heat, light, water, electricity, but emotional energies are different for both. So spirits who've crossed use love, faith, and hope. Ghosts use negative emotional energies of fear, anxiety, depression, and anger. And so ghosts are stuck in the place they chose. But spirits can visit us anywhere in the world, anytime.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, once again, making that definition very clear, the understanding that, you know, a ghost is almost trauma-centric. You know, as to how they died, when they died, what they are attached to at the time. And that even brings up the point of, like, you know, articles being haunted by something, not necessarily a location, you know, a child's favorite toy, what have you, things like that, not necessarily the child's room. But there is that definite difference between that and spirit, because the spirit, even though it is still the what we are, so to speak. It isn't like it's a rote tape that's being played out or the memory of something that's being played out. It's almost like there is an intention behind spirit, whether it be to help you, guide you, be there for you emotionally, what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Now,
that's what they do. Yeah. It seems to me that ghosts are actually more, they become more selfish when they become ghosts, because ultimately they realize they made the wrong choice and they need our help to cross over and become a spirit.
Interesting. So one doesn't necessarily prevent the other. One is kind of a lockstep that happens before they realize that they have an option, or that they had an option and chose poorly.
That's it. They had an option and they chose poorly. And I've actually found that sometimes they intentionally choose poorly, because they're often afraid that any transgressions that they made during life will be judged too harshly, and they'll be sent to a bad place. But in my experience in talking to spirit, there is no bad place. There's just peace and love and acceptance and kindness on the other side.
Yeah.
So they're missing out.
Well, and you know, let's explore that for a second, because, and especially the human trauma centric part of that, Rob, because with that comes the fact that sadly and horribly enough, your family member, your loved one that may not have crossed over, may not have crossed over because of you and because of your trauma of their loss.
There's all kinds of reasons why they would stay behind.
Now, let's begin exploring the idea of animal spirits and the idea of animals, A, going into the afterlife, and B, not just going into the afterlife, but being there for us after. Because once again, the idea of a spirit being there, like I said, I predicate things on that idea of just vibrational reality. To me, the idea of ghosts, paranormal, things like that, it's literally a bubble that is adjoining ours vibrationally. Mm-hmm. You know, like we're in a big tub of suds in the universe, and that's just a bubble adjoining our bubble, you know. So that membrane isn't hugely crazy to penetrate, to pass through, to be able to vibrationally pass through, especially once you're in a higher vibrational rate, you know. But how do you as a medium, Rob, begin to filter spirit and ghost?
In addition to being about the different energies, so ghosts draw on negative emotional energies, which are fear, anxiety, depression, and anger, versus the spirits who've crossed over, who draw on love, faith, and hope. So when I'm in the presence of an entity, I can sense whether they're negative emotions coming from them or positive emotions. And that helps me differentiate if they've crossed over or if they're just and visiting at, or they're if they're just earthbound.
Okay. Now, how do you begin to understand the difference between an animal spirit and a person spirit? Is there, it's very obvious in this vibrational world, which is which, you know, which is a dog, which is a cat. but how do you differentiate that mediumship wise whenever it comes to stepping onto a property or going to help somebody connect with perhaps a past pet, a past loved one, something like that?
Well, to me, it's kind of easy because animals really are all about love. And humans, unfortunately, are not.
Yeah. Sadly and horribly, yeah.
Yeah, sadly. Humans have too many hang-ups, which is actually why I decided years ago that I was not going to do any spirit readings for people who cross over.
Oh, wow.
Only pets.
Wow. Now is that something that the spirits have necessarily themselves abided by as well? Or have there been moments where, you know, a human spirit is just like, no, seriously, you need to tell somebody this?
Yeah, there have been times, and it's always when I'm doing the pet reading. some demon spirits will barge their way in and tell me a few things about themselves. and I'll, you know, I'll have to share them. I just did a reading for a little dog in that was from South Africa. And, there was a woman who told me that she always wore flowered sundresses. She had nothing but flowered sundresses, and she was the one that greeted this dog on the other side. And she said a couple of other things. And when I passed that message on, the pet parent that wrote me said, "Oh my gosh, that's my mother-in-law. She had nothing but flowered sundresses in her in her wardrobe." So I know exactly who that is. But yeah, so while pets are trying to tell me something, humans will sometimes interfere.
And you. How do you begin a session? Let's walk the audience through what a reading is for you, Rob.
Sure. So so I do pet readings, and I do them on weekends, and I do them by email. And the reason I do them by email is because I really have to pay attention to what they're saying to me. I can't be talking to a human and listening very closely. And I'll give you an example in a minute. So what I need is a picture of the pet, the pet's name, and any questions that the pet parent may have, and also the people who live with the pet in case the pet wants to address them or if they want to be addressed by the pet in the reading. So usually when the pet comes through, the pet will get into a big data dump of things, anything and everything. And then by the time I get to read the email with the questions, the pet has usually answered everything right from the beginning.
Okay.
So one example of why I need to do it by email and not talk to people just happened this past weekend. I was doing a little dog, same little dog that I mentioned, whose the mother-in-law came in the flower dress. This little dog, when I first connected to this dog, I started to feel fuzziness in my left eye. It's kind of, it was sticky, it was blurry, there was something going on. And the dog suddenly told me a word that I've never heard of, and it was Ongwe. And I thought, okay, I don't know what that is. So I asked the dog to show me the spelling, and I wrote O-O-I-N-G, and then another word, W-A-Y. And I thought, okay, I have no idea what that is. So I said, I'm going to put that aside in the reading, just going to continue, and I did. And the dog was telling me about various issues with vision and sight and so forth. And then the mother-in-law who passed away came through, and then I stopped and I thought, wait a minute, I need to read the rest of this email. So I read the rest of the email. At the very bottom of it, it said, P.S. We live in South Africa. We speak English and Afrikaans. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I took the word and I put it in Google Translator. And do you know it means I, E-Y-E, and the other way means entrance. So when I sent that, I was startled that this little dog taught me a word in Afrikaans.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and when I sent the reading, the mother confirmed this little dog had detached retina. They went in through the eye, like the eye entrance, to try and do surgery. So I was astounded. I'm learning words in different languages from pets.
Wow. That is, and that's interesting, the fact that it would be able to communicate that to you in such a clear and concise way, Rob.
So anytime a pet hears a word, they can repeat it.
I can imagine that, because that is one of the things that they've at least shown by science, is that pets understand far more than just the unction of your words. And that goes into even various cultures and languages. Like, it's fascinating to know that, like, a dog that lives its life in an English-speaking household can be trained in German.
Yes.
And fully understand every one of those German commands and what they mean. It's really, really interesting to see that. The fact that animals are distinctly above language in that kind of way. It's fascinating to see that that they truly do have cognate of vocabulary amongst various languages. And even the way that we process animal sounds, that's always been a fascinating one to me, that the fact that animals and the way that they sound different in countries around the world. We say that dogs say woof woof. You go to Italy and it's oof oof. You know, it's fascinating to see how we have different words all over the world, but that dog in the same way is absolutely multilingual and understands the same thing, whether it's coming from somebody in English or in Italian. Does that have to do more, do you think, with their emotional intelligence or spiritual intelligence, Rob? The idea that they're more tied to us in that kind of way.
I think it's both, really. In my Pets in the Afterlife series of books, I explain that dogs learn on different levels. There is learning, there's language learning, there is emotional learning, there is social skills that we train them. They learn different how to interact socially with other dogs. You know, they learn routine. They learn how to go, you know, where to go to the bathroom. They know when we're taking them to the doctor when they're sick. So they learn on all these different levels. And that said, they can also learn different languages too, and they also read tone as well.
Yeah, they are, and more than that, it's also microfacial features, things like that. That is something that is massively, massively important in the animal kingdom, beyond the world of sound and smell, things like that. Is the idea of micro features and facial expressions, things like that. They know whether you are upset or not, whether you say anything, because they can literally read it on your face. And it's fascinating to see that.
They absolutely can. And, you know, it's funny you're talking about expressions, because one of our three dogs is a very expressive dog. And I'm going to show you a postcard that I had made, one of our Christmas cards. And you can tell who the naughty one is if you look up there. By the little smirk on his face.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, so he has some issues. He's actually on Prozac, but but they do. They have their own expressions.
Good for him for seeking the help he needs. If only we were all so enlightened, Rob. But in all sincerity, you know, it is really fascinating to me. I was telling you pre-show about a cat that we had, my wife's cat, Leon. He passed this last, I guess it was May. I was coming back from the road. They were coming back from the road. And came back. Leon was older to begin with. He was, but something had gotten a hold of him one night when he was outside, unbeknownst to my wife. And he took ill and took ill rapidly. But he was, fortunately, he was more than gentle and loving, his whole life. And we had another small cat. That my son had rescued from our old backyard. And this other cat was never a cuddler, never a lap cat, nothing like that. Leon, on the other hand, despite the fact that he was a 20-pound cat, would still climb up on my wife's shoulder as though he was a kitten to get love every night. So here's this huge cat that would insistently come and lay over my wife's shoulder and just drool all over her incessantly because he did just full of so much love. He couldn't not drool everywhere. And it was very interesting too, with, and I mean in quick turnaround, Rob. We were all there when Leon died. He died with the family. We were all surrounding him with love. And even the baby cat was there, Floyd. Within 24 hours of Leon leaving the house, going to the vet, all that kind of stuff after he passed, the baby cat Floyd began climbing up on my wife's chest to love on her at night. This was not an action he had ever done, ever. He is a cat that if you pick him up and try to give him a hug, he will kick and fight you to get away from that hug. He'll come up and love on you and everything else, but he was not a lap cat. He is now. And it's interesting to, and I told her, I was like, he told him how to love on you. Like, no doubt. He left the message that this is the love she needs, like above anything else in the house. You make sure and take care of her the way she needs to be taken care of.
So that's a perfect example of what I've been taught by spirit of pets, is that they will, once they pass, they will come back and they will either teach your current pet to do something that they used to do.
Yep.
So that you will know that they are still around in spirit. Or if you adopt another pet, a new pet, and bring the pet in the house, they will be there to do the same thing to them. So you'll notice these signs, these similar actions in another pet once one passes. And that's just one of the ways that they show they're around.
And it was really fascinating because I've heard these things before. I had never, ever seen it in action, Rob, until I saw that happen. And it floored me and flabbergasted me. And to this day, to see some of the mannerisms that he has picked up from Leon, some of the ways that he interacts with that, because we got the boy and Floyd, because Floyd's only about 3 years old. And I was like, we can't go too long without him having another brother in the house. Like, he needs to pick up the mantle of being big brother. So we got a kitten for Christmas for my son and for him. And to see him take to the new cat and teach him and pass things on. Like, he's taught him to drink water out of the faucet. Things oh, wow. like that. You know, it's just fascinating. And to see him pick up that kind of love and love on him the same way that Leon loved on Floyd is really fascinating to see. And I think truly a testament to the fact that, yes, there is a spirit there. There is something there that carries on and permeates and stays no different than with a human, Rob.
Yeah, and that brings up another point, too, is that our pets in spirit will actually lead us to the next pet they want us to adopt. We saw that here in my family, that our dog Cody, the one with the grin there, the evil grin. So he shows a lot of habits that our dachshund Franklin had, and Franklin passed in 2020. And we didn't adopt Cody until 2022, and Cody was 10 years old. He was a rescue, and sadly abused rescue. But Cody has the same exact amount of stubbornness, same kind of habits that Franklin had. It's pretty amazing.
Well, and let's explore that section real quick of adoption, Rob, because of course, if anybody has ever adopted, be it human or fur baby, you will know that there is a love there that is beyond any other. But especially when you're talking about pets, adoption, and that arc of abuse to adoption to forever home to passing. Mm-hmm. How does that arc affect the spirit of an animal?
Well, it's really kind of a healing journey for them, as it same as it is with people.
Sure.
And it's for them, it's because they don't speak, you know, our language. It's a matter of learning that they can trust us.
Okay.
Because their previous home was not trustworthy. So sometimes it takes a while. You know, we've had Cody 2.5 years. I mean, he still has some trust issues because of the different actions that his previous home had done to him. You know, you can't walk by him very closely, otherwise he'll lash out to try and bite you. Mm. Because obviously he was kicked when he was in his previous home, which is just outrageous.
Yeah.
But it's a healing journey. And one thing that people need to know is that when you adopt a pet that was in a previous home where the pet was abused, that pet is not going to link to those abusers on the other side. Mm. They will only link to where the love was.
Interesting. And that's good to hear. That's good to know. You know, the fact that they are looking for and craving that connection to love still. And as opposed to, to loop it back to earlier, the idea of a human ghost or a human spirit, you know, because that was my next question was, of course, you hear about, you know, haunted locations, things like that, where more than one ghost is there. And I will make that differentiation here between ghost and spirit, because the ghost is locked there via trauma. Are there cases that you have run across or that you've heard about during your time in mediumship of traumatic experiences of animals on the other side where they are locked in that ghostly pattern, Rob?
No, not from domesticated animals.
Okay.
I'm sure that wild animals have, but I'm unable to communicate with wild animals.
Interesting.
Because wild animals don't know our habits. They don't know our language. They don't. There's nothing they can relate to with us. So people often ask me if I can communicate with a grizzly bear, and the answer is no.
Yeah, I was just about to add because you know there does have to be that consent. Both ways. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't know the grizzly bear necessarily wants to run into you in the woods to begin with, much less talk to you in the afterlife. You know, he's probably still busy being kind of grizzly bear, you know, and living a lovely grizzly bear life. because it's one of those they don't necessarily have that social bond in this kind of way. And it's fascinating to even explore the idea, because there is that tie between wolf, dog, and it's not that far in the distant past, you know, like quite literally every dog as we know it has been crossbred from wolves down within like 600 years, 1,000 years. Like it's not a specific delineation that happened on its own. This was something that happened due to our intervention, you know, which even to bring that back to the idea of language and why dogs and cats understand so many languages, I think it really is the fact of because across humanity, despite jungle or desert or what have you, we have domesticated these animals as a means of companionship, mm-hmm. and a means of mutual use, you know, be it to keep rodent population in a village down, and that's why we keep the cats and feed them scraps, and that's why they stay around and in proximity to us and eventually live within our doors. Or, you know, whether it's the fact of five different tribes in a localized area all speaking different languages culled the wolves closer to them with table scraps, you know, and that's how different ranges of dogs came to be. So, yeah, they, through that cooperation with us, have quite literally learned our languages and the differences between us. The same way that we have culled them down to like, hey, we need something to chase rats inside of tunnels. Let's make a rat terrier, you know. Right. Let's take a dog that used to wrestle bulls and breed it down to something this big, and now it still wants to go after something like a bull, but it's only big enough to take on a rat.
That would be like a chihuahua. They would fight a bull.
Well, no, but precisely that's how they came to be. You know, it was like they took this bullfighting breed and were like, well, we need them for this, so let's just take the smallest ones and breed them with the smallest ones till they come all the way down, and you end up with a critter that has the exact same tenacity as its bigger, older cousin, you know, but is purposefully bred for its intention. And it's fascinating to see how that affects the way that we interact with them. And if that affects their spiritual well-being after, you know, because there is that idea that if you have a border collie, man, you better have some room to run that animal, because that's what it does, you know. Yeah. And if you want a happy border collie, it needs time to run. It can't be rushed to do that. It's a job that it's been bred into, is to run and nip at things and keep them in line,
right?
You know, and if you don't give it sheep to keep in line, it will keep your children in line, you know.
Well, that's
like
not a bad
it
thing.
Will herd them. You know, it's not a bad thing necessarily, but it's fascinating to see that. And does that do the jobs that animals have specifically, besides the job of love like we were talking about, do these jobs that they've been bred for and that they've been trained for translate over to the other side, Rob?
Yeah, sometimes they do, especially when they're trying to communicate with us. So I've learned that pets, whatever pets do in life, they will do from spirit to give us messages. So yeah, with border collies, you know, as you mentioned, you may feel a nip or you may feel a nudge after your border collie passed, and that would be your border collie still hurting you, if you will. Hurting, H-E-R-D-I-N-G,
yes.
Not hurting.
Yeah.
Because they still do the same thing that they did in life.
Yeah, precisely. They're still driven by you, because that's what brought you pleasure, was watching them do what they did. You know, so they're still going to want to love on you in the same way, and it's fascinating to see that. Now let's begin talking in these last few minutes. We've got you for about another 20 minutes or so, Rob.
Okay.
Let's move the conversation from the animal to the human. At what point, because like you said, there was a point of differentiation for you, mediumship wise. And one of the questions I always have for mediums, because I'm no medium. I would say that I've done a little bit of remote viewing, things like that. But I've definitely got I guess what you would say is almost an empathetic side, where I can walk into a room and know who I need to talk to, you
yes.
know? And there was definitely a point in life, man, where it was like I no longer wanted to feel that onus upon me. I no longer wanted to walk in the room and feel my belly pull me somewhere. You know, so I made a hard differentiation in life. And, you know, sadly, that led to some disconnection from that for a long time. A lot of it's coming back, and it's beautiful. But what was it for you that made that hard line delineation between, like, I will work with animal over human?
It was actually one reading that I did. It was a reading that I did for a woman who asked me to communicate with her dad who passed away. And and I said, sure. You know, this was years ago. And her dad came through, and he was an alcoholic, and he was physically abusive, and he did other things. And it was really hard for me to put these things in an email to a complete stranger whom, you know, I don't know what she looks like. I don't know her last name. I don't know anything about her. I had to convey that. And I thought, and I told her in the reading, I said, look, he's begging for forgiveness. He was not in his right mind. This is what it's all about. And I really, frankly, feel uncomfortable sharing this. So she wrote me back, and she unfortunately confirmed everything that her dad said in spirit. And I said, you know what? People have too many hangups. I am not going to deal with people in spirit. I'll help earthbound ghosts. So the difference is, I will read earthbound ghosts and help them cross over. But I'm not going to deal with the spirit of a human, because they're going to share, they're going to open their closet.
They're going to trauma dump on you.
Yeah, they're going to trauma
dump. I mean, there's literally no other turn of phrase other than the modern turn of phrase of trauma dump. Because that's what it is. That's what it is.
And, you know, if, frankly, it takes an emotional toll on me, number one, to do any reading.
Yeah.
But it also took a psychological toll on me, too, because I'm connecting here with a man who was abusive in many ways. And it didn't feel good.
Yeah.
And I had to try and purge that before, you know, I called it a night. And it's tough.
It's a special kind of compartmentalization. You know, it's no different. The only analogies I can give, Rob, is no different than any therapist sitting in a chair, or no different than any priest sitting on the other side of a veil in a confessional.
Sure.
You know, where it's like that will take a toll on you. Hearing that and having that happen, you know, and it's same thing as a cop on the street, man. Like, you see things, you hear things, that the average citizen does not. And it's always something that I've asked of every medium, every psychic that has come on the show, is how do you filter yourself? Because, I mean, of course, once again, these spirits sometimes still invade a session uninvited. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like you've got to kind of give them their credence whenever they pop through, you know, which you do. But how do you filter that? How do you keep that? Because can you keep that from just happening, you know, upon you and being thrust upon you?
Yeah, I don't think you can really. If they wanted to come through, they're going to come through no matter what, because they can be really strong. But it's a matter of how you deal with the energy and the memory that they shared with that. And, you know, afterward, you know, you can take a shower, because water energy is purifying. You know, I always read a book before I go to bed. I hug my dogs. You know, something like that. But I'm also the kind of guy who's very emotional. You know, most mediums are very emotional. And and I dwell on things. And sometimes I dream about them. And it makes me crazy.
Yeah.
So, you know, before you go to bed, you know, a Benadryl will help too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, well, something to help that disconnection. Because once again, it can be hard to hang up the line. You know?
Yes.
And that's really the only way to put it is, you know, if you remember back, like nowadays we have do not disturb and vibrate, all kinds of modes. Back in the day, your only choice was to unplug the phone, man. You know, like that's it. Most phones didn't have a mute on the ringer or something like that. You just unplug the line. Like, that's all you could do. Was hard that. Unplug. So, and it's interesting to me because, once again, that was something that sadly led to bad places in my life. The want to disconnect, you know, and I understand that. I think I especially spiritually understand the struggle of a lot of addicts in that kind of way, because the world is a hard and crushing place to begin with, much less once you add connection to other human beings and their trauma around you, you know, and much less if you're someone like yourself who, in addition to those just everyday struggles going on, you have a spiritual world that impresses itself upon you in a different way and with a different onus than the rest of the world, you know, that can take a large, large toll on people. So, good for you for recognizing that in yourself and realizing that is not the energy that you want to work with, you know?
Yeah. You have to, you know, as with anything, you really have to set borders in life about what you want to deal with, what you can deal with, and, you know, move away from things that adversely, negatively affect you. I mean, just like families at over holidays, you know, with opposing viewpoints of things. If they're going to make you feel bad, then don't associate with them. Yeah. They are family, but you are you are only fighting for yourself.
Well, and, you know, that brings up a big point that we have talked about for a long time on this show, Rob, whether it comes to paranormal, what have you, even experiences that are thrust upon you. Where is your point of consent? You know, at what point have you consented into a system? At what point have you consented into a system of anger? You know, and the idea of like, well, no, if I go, I'm going to have this argument. Well, yeah, you've now fully consented to have the argument should it present itself. You know, right. You could consent to not have that argument, too, and still go. Like there's an option there. And much,
yeah, there's an option.
Much like you were saying at the beginning with that choice of ghost or spirit, there's an option. There's an option. The light is presented. The question is whether or not the spirit turns towards the light or stays here and is bound by the trauma or is bound by the trauma of the person remaining, even like we were talking about, you know, the idea that sadly and horribly, sometimes our processing of our grief is what keeps them here. You know, because they're trying to do the spirit thing, which is help us. And move us forward when really it's them moving forward and into the light that will help us.
Exactly.
You know, and
yes,
it's very interesting to see that dichotomy that happens once crossing has begun. How does that begin a haunting? Especially, you know, one like the Haunting of Emery Estate. Here in the next 15 minutes that we have you for, let's get into the Haunting of Emery Estate and how that came to be, Rob.
Sure. So that's my latest book. I can show it to you. This book just came out on January 1st. I was invited to participate in a paranormal investigation of Emery Estate, its property in Massachusetts. And I knew nothing about the property. Before I ever go on a paranormal investigation, I don't look anything up. In fact, I didn't even know where it was. And what's ironic about that is that I grew up in the next town from where the estate was located.
Yeah. That is entirely a Massachusetts situation, man. The number of people I know that lived in Massachusetts are like, oh yeah, I should go to Salem.
Right.
It's like everybody grows up down the road from this crazy, wild, and there are tons of large properties that were used as convalescent homes, all kinds of things, you know, mental institutions. There's the ones right down the road from Salem that's famously haunted. So yeah, like Massachusetts is steeped in it. So to know that you grew up right down the road from this property, but had no idea of the story. How did you become involved with this?
So this is kind of a crazy story. It's a lot of fun. I went to the Massachusetts Paracon a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And when I was there, I was supposed to speak about pets in the afterlife and how they communicate. And when I was there, I was tracked down by a woman named Monique Toussoun. She's the only paranormal investigator drag queen in the country, and she is fascinating. She decided during COVID to dress up in drag and go on paranormal investigations because she couldn't perform anywhere, of course. And she learned that made her a trigger object for ghosts who were trying to understand her. So she had sought me out because she wanted a pet reading, and I did. I gave her a pet reading. I was also on her program. I talked about pets in the afterlife and so forth. And then she had me back because she loved the pet reading that I gave her. And then she asked me to go on this investigation. So I did. Long story short, we wound up being two of three people on a team together, and we knew nothing about this estate. We distinctly communicated with three ghosts, earthbound ghosts.
Wow.
One was an innocent boy. One was someone who was attached to a piece of furniture that didn't come with the house. The boy didn't come with the house. The boy didn't even live in the house. And the other one was a grown man who had a very awful personality. And at the end of the investigation, really pulled a fast one on us. Because we were trying to help one of the other ghosts.
Okay.
And this guy was a jerk, if I may say so, because he was obviously a jerk in life.
Yeah,
so,
having none of it.
If you're a jerk in life and you don't cross over, you still remain a jerk in death.
Isn't it strange how that just kind of maintains?
Yeah. Came very clear. But we had no idea. So, you know, our whole purpose there, and this was a public investigation, by the way. This was open to the public.
Great.
Because we had three rotating teams of the public. I think there were 20 people or 15 people in each group. The other interesting aspect of this case, I mean, there are many interesting aspects to the case, and I urge everybody to pick up a copy because you will learn how different ghosts react and associate with people. The other interesting aspect of this case is that there was one person in this public investigation that was adversely physically and mentally affected.
Oh, wow.
By a ghost because of their negative emotional energy that they were emitting.
Interesting. And I have definitely seen people get nauseous on investigations, things like that, where they have just had bad energies. I myself have had that happen. However, the one thing that I find fascinating amongst your story here, Rob, is that you did not research this property prior to going to it. You didn't know anything about it. That is one of my favorite topics that I talk about, is the idea of, like, how often are we possibly charging an atmosphere? Mm-hmm. Because if you're getting ready to go research a property, like, you're going on social media and, hey, everybody, tell me your stories about this place. And it's like you're almost literally polishing the filter through which you're going to look at all of your evidence that you gather.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, like you're setting yourself up almost to have an experience and may very well psychically anyway be actively charging the area for that experience to begin with, you know? The idea that y'all went in blind with zero research into this, zero preconceived notions, zero ideas of what spirits had done to people in the past, what other people's experiences had been, lends a lot of credence to these experiences to me.
That's a big rule of thumb for me, because as a medium, I don't want to know where it is. I don't want to know anything about it. Just an hour before I have to get there, give me directions, or 2 hours, however long it takes to get there, and I'll show up. When I got there, I will tell you that I made a short video. There's a link to it in the book, in the first chapter. And I distinctly remember saying, wow, I get some really adverse feelings of dread before I go in here. So let's see what's happening in here. And by the way, the other thing, there's another little aspect of this that people may not know if they haven't read anything that I've written, is that when I go on paranormal investigations, I can see ghosts in my mind. I can actually see what they look like. So I sketched them out. I don't know if you can see that.
Epic. I love it.
So I sketched them out. And whenever I've gone on paranormal investigations in private homes and I've sketched them out, those sketches are shown to the homeowners. And when they were, the homeowners always said, and I'm very humbled by this, that was the ghost that they saw walking through their house.
Wow. That is absolutely incredible to know that you sketch those things, that kind of stuff.
Crazy.
after we end, please do. I mean, we're connected. Make sure to send me your address. I'll send you a copy of our observation and field log, because quite literally, that's what it's for. And it's got a little section where you can sketch, but it's for gathering that data in the field as it happens. Because so sadly, Rob, too many people on investigation are not necessarily walking around with a notebook, much less taking taking the time to write down experience as it occurs. You know, all too readily, those things are gathered afterward. You know, and it's kind of sad, because at that point, once again, the process of data corruption has already begun. You know, you've already started processing that experiences through your lens of life experience, or your lens of religious belief, through your lens of paranormal belief, you know, instead of gathering it raw as it happened. You know,
So and that's one of the things. That's the other thing that I do when I go on paranormal investigations. I have a journal, a blank journal. And when we were in Emory Estate, when we were experiencing these things, I was writing things down. And Monique looked at me and she said, "How in the world are you writing in the dark?" And I said, "You know, after 30 years of doing this, I can write in the dark."
Yeah,
I can read my own writing in the dark.
You know, that's like my friends. They could keep eye contact with the professor and still stay on the line in the notebook. I have no idea how they did it, but there are people who have that skill set, you know, who can take notes like that without writing over their own handwriting and without looking at the page.
Mine is like this.
Yeah. But this sounds like an incredible case study of a book, Rob. We've got to have you back on the show to literally just talk about this, because I'm always incredibly enthralled by the world of research and how people go about doing their research on site, how they go about culling their data, the idea of a ride or die, somebody that you work with hand in hand. Who is willing to question your data, who's willing to question your methods. And when they question you, you aren't going to get bristly about it, you know, because that's how field work actually happens. That's how science happens, you know, and all of these things are coming to a head with science right now. Every one of them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I always incorporate a lot of science in my my books, because I'm a meteorologist by trade. So I use the science of energy to explain the paranormal. I can explain cold spots. I recently understood exactly why ghosts get trapped and they can't cross over after a while. So there's a whole bunch of things I use energy to explain.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's one of those I find much like I don't think that any of these topics in the paranormal conflict with anything religiously or spiritually anywhere. I don't think they conflict with science either. You know, one of my favorite books that I have is this little number right here, which is an actual desk scientific reference. And it's a whole series.
Cool.
I mean, it's full of things like articles from like the 1870s on ball lightning and, you know, green meteorites and just different things in the sky and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Because, well, if you don't understand the phenomena, you're not going to understand the science. And in science, you have to account for the phenomena and remove it from the data set so that you're left with nothing but fact. So, the fact that science is once again embracing the phenomena, Rob, is a beautiful thing to me. And I think a lot of people have unfortunately given science a really bad name, and fully see it as, sadly, the enemy to a lot of these disciplines when it comes to parapsychological research, be it spirits and ghosts or cryptozoology, or which is actual science. Like, I'd love to say it's not like that. That's how we find new species, you know?
So
it's fascinating to me to see how these worlds are merging together. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to get a reading themselves. You also do classes with spirit readings, things like that. So let everybody know where they can go to follow your work, where they can go to get in touch with you for readings, for classes, and where they can go to get their personal copy of the all new Haunted Emery Estate.
Well, thanks. So they can find me on robgutro.com. If they can't spell my last name, they can just go to petspirits.com. It all goes to the same place. All my books are on Amazon. They're in paperback. They're in ebook, and then they're in audiobook as well. So for pet readings, you have to go through robgutro.com. Send me an email. My email and how pet readings are done are all up there. But advance notice, I am booked 1 year out. You have to be
good for you.
Patient. Yeah, I know. There's a high demand. I am doing a lot of public appearances. I do teach adult education in two schools up in northern New England every week. You can find everything on my events page. I do talks at libraries. I do fundraising animal rescues. So if you have an animal rescue that wants a fundraiser where I teach the people how to how pets communicate and how to see signs, just get in touch with me because I don't charge the rescues anything. Rescues take in whatever they charge for a ticket. And that it all goes to rescues for dogs and cats.
That is beautiful.
I'm booked with events all the way out to September already. it's a great crazy thing.
Well, that is fantastic to hear. I love nothing more than knowing that people like you who are out there doing good work to help people lift their vibration in the world and find wholesome healing ways, Rob, that people like you are nothing more than thronged with business, because that is what the world needs, my friend, is nothing more than more love and more understanding of where we're all supposed to be, and understanding that we are all surrounded by, if you want to call them angels, call them angels, folks, but we are all surrounded by our loved ones at all time. They've never left us. They're here the whole time, all the time. Always know that, everybody. So, Rob, thank you so much for your time tonight. I greatly appreciate it. I'll be sharing links for the episode, all that kind of stuff with you. And we've got to have you on again very soon.
That'd be great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Take care, my friend. While you are online checking out everything from Rob Guttrow, everybody, at robguttrow.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all our episodes. That is where you can also follow us on Ground Zero Media. We are officially a member of the Ground Zero Media Network and KGRA as well. So you can find us there. You can also download the free Curious Realm app from our good friends at APR TV. If you are a Roku user, you can get the free app. It has not only all of the episodes, but tons of binaural beat music by yours truly, as well as some fantastic chakra meditation videos. Please hold on through this quick commercial break. When we come back, we will be joined by our good friend, the professor himself, Richard B. Spence. We will be talking about the Illuminati, the founding of it. Is the Illuminati still around? Are they influencing media and the world as we know it? More about that when we come back from this quick break right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them.
Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and thank you so much for staying tuned through that break. And also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially Truhem Science. Truhem Science is your source for amazing CBD products. I have been using their stuff for many years. It is absolutely awesome. If you have been recommended CBD by your doctor like I had, stop on by, check them out. They produce some fantastic stuff. Christopher Lynch is based right here in Austin, Texas. He uses a full spigeric process where every part of the plant is used, reused, combusted, and reused until absolutely nothing remains. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHemScience.com is the website that you want to use. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to get 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two edibles as well. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Professor Richard B. Spence. He is Professor Emeritus at University of Idaho. He is also the author of Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence and the Occult, as well as a very, very poignant book these days, Wall Street and the Russian Revolution, 1905 to 1925. He has hosted numerous classes on the great courses, Wondrium, things like that, on everything from the occult to history, to lost history, and what we're talking about tonight, secret societies and the Illuminati. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Spence. How have you been?
I've been doing well. Thanks for having me back on.
Absolutely. I hope you have been able to enjoy your retirement and really dig your teeth into some more research, things like that. I know as awesome as teaching university is, sometimes you do not get the chance to really explore your own avenues of research as deeply as you like to because of, well, the responsibilities of an actual school schedule, you know.
Well, there's that. There's also committee meetings. I no longer have to sit on any committees, which
wow.
is a relief.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad of that. But yeah, one of the things you can do in retirement, I'm still staying busier than I would. Well, I don't know. I think I'm staying busier than I would like, you know, when the urge to lie down strikes me. But here's the type of thing. But when the urge to lie down strikes me, I can just go and lie down. I don't have any other things to do, generally,
right,
unless I'm driving. So
well,
there we go.
Last time we had you on, you were actually just wrapping with the series that I just got done watching. That was all about secret societies and the history of secret societies throughout humanity. It was absolutely awesome. And what really rung my bell, especially with everything going on in the world right now, things like that, was the episode on the Illuminati. And I was like, I've got to get Dr. Spence back on to just dig into the actualities of the Illuminati, the realities of the Illuminati, the myths of them. I think it's one of those topics that kind of like Masonry, I think even more than Masonry though, because Masonry is something that people can still go shake a hand with. Masonry is still something that they see in their, you know, like small town 4th of July parade, things like that, you know? But Illuminati was there and then gone. And it seems like people have kind of woven it into the fabric of modern society, even to the point of like, you know, rock and roll in the movie industry are run by the Illuminati.
Yes.
It's fascinating to see where things go with this. So Let's begin at the beginning, Doctor. How did the Illuminati begin? The actual Illuminati, the real group that did factually exist.
Well, let's go back a little bit further than that.
Please.
And do what I always like to do, which is get a basic definition. So you got this term, Illuminati, which is the plural, or the singular. If you're just one of you, you're an Illuminatus. So what is that exactly? One, it's a term which has been widely used, or let's say it has been regularly used throughout history before the 18th century by various groups to describe themselves. And all it actually means is this, that you have seen the light, that you are illuminated, and specifically that you are illuminated to some knowledge or truth. Now, it doesn't tell you what the knowledge or truth is. It reveals nothing about what it is that you have been illuminated to, but simply that you now have this kind of special or exalted state. So, for instance, if you go back to the Roman era and the early centuries of Christianity, one of the terms, in fact, the main term in which Christians used to refer to themselves as were Illuminati. We have seen the light, the light of the Gospels. We have been illuminated to the truth. So it was used by early Christians. It was used by anyone who wanted to claim that they had some kind of special knowledge. You find equivalents to it in the Islamic realm. In the Middle Ages, you had a mystical group in what's now Afghanistan, the Roshaniya, the Illuminated Ones, the Illuminati. Who use that term. Now, there raises a kind of interesting question. Does it mean that everyone throughout the centuries or millennia which have called themselves illuminated are all illuminated to the same thing, that there's some kind of continuum? And I have to answer that simply because, you know, the example being that this was a term used by early Christians who I don't think were applying that generally to anything else. No, but you see how one term can be used by different groups at different times that are related to each other only in the sense that they believe they have some kind of special knowledge. So it's a fairly generic term. It's not an original term. It's not a term which is specific to any time or place. Yeah, okay. You're also mentioning here that in medieval Spain, there were the alumbrados, you know, illuminated group who may have had some contact both. Well, there may have been contacts to Gnosticism, to Islamic mysticism. Medieval Spain was an area where
absolutely kind of
Christian, mystical, and Islamic worlds all intertwined with each other. I mean, there was Jewish mysticism, Christian mysticism, and Islamic mysticism all kind of mixing together, and people were illuminated.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing about it is that it's a term that actually describes nothing. Only some sort of generalized state of being that those who use the term believe they have. But it doesn't tell you, again, what the illumination consists of. That's always the fundamental mystery. So with that out of the way, let's segue up to the 18th century. You know, the century of, okay, of what? What do you call that? The Enlightenment.
Yeah.
There you go. So think of it. I mean, the 18th century is sort of the century of the Illuminati. The whole thing is supposedly enlightened. And we'll go to what's now Germany, what was then Bavaria. And so, you know, Bavaria is still there, the southern part of Germany, and specifically to the city of Ingolstadt, which had a university, a Catholic Jesuit university. And that's kind of normal for the time. Most universities were church-related, and the Jesuits played a big role in education. Ingolstadt also shows up in another interesting context that maybe we'll come back to. Any of you Frankenstein fans out there, you know, Mary Shelley's book, will realize that Dr. Frankenstein is in Ingolstadt, the same place. There's a fictional character at a real university. And there are some, we may get back to this, I'll leave it alone for now, who think that there's actually some kind of connection to that the fact that the fictional Frankenstein is set in Ingolstadt and that the birthplace of the historical Bavarian Illuminati is in that same city is not coincidental. So we're in Ingolstadt, Bavaria, and we'll take the year 1776. You know, if you're an American, you know what that means.
Yeah.
It's the Declaration of Independence. Well, it's also the year at which the Bavarian Illuminati are conjured into existence in Ingolstadt. And on a specific day, we know that. It's on the 1st of May, a day that will later become synonymous with May Day, a labor celebration, you know, later sort of commie Christmas. All right, that's May Day. It had a significance even in the 18th century. The significance of May Day there is that it's Beltane. It's part of this, a very old sort of seasonal, some would argue, pagan celebration, but you know, everything was at one point. But you've got these, keep in mind, if you look at the old sort of what could be called the occult calendar or the seasonal calendar, these days are, it's always the evening and then the next day. That's what you're doing. So yep. You've got the 30th of April, which if you look that up is sometimes called Walpurgis Nacht, Walpurgis Night, you know, the celebration of the witches. This is when they all got together and had a big witch party.
Yep.
But then that just segues over in the morning into Beltane, the sort of fire festival. So the 1st of May and the 30th of April are the same thing in the same way that October 31st, All Saints Eve, then just segues into November 1st, All Saints Day.
Right.
Okay. The Day of the Dead. So it's, you know, it's the whole sort of death festival.
Yeah,
in
the Catholic Church, that's literally what Vespers is the beginning of that cycle from the day previous, like Christmas Eve into Christmas Day. You have Vespers Mass, which is what, you know, kind of is the same thing as going to temple in Judaic religion on a Friday night.
Exactly. It begins in the evening and that's it goes into the next day. Christmas Eve, Christmas Day. They're all sort of arranged in that way. So we don't know if the man who created this organization, and we know his name as well. His name was Adam Weishaupt. I'll say a little bit more about him in a minute, but Adam Weishaupt was, did he pick this day because of its pagan association? One would assume it's kind of historical association with the seasons. Basically what that is noting is the midway point between the spring equinox and the summer solstice. So that's the way the sort of calendar, you know, what some people again call the witch's calendar, but it's not necessarily, it's just the natural calendar.
Yeah.
We've got solstices, we've got two equinoxes, and you've got the midpoints between them. And every one of those corresponds to some kind of a holiday. We've forgotten what a lot of those are, but Groundhog's Day is one of those, Midsummer's Eve. They all fit into this. So I would assume that Weishaupt picked the 1st of May, the historic Beltane, for some reason, if it wasn't religious, at least as a kind of commemoration, the beginning of spring, perhaps. So who was Adam Weishaupt? He was a professor of canon law at the University of Ingolstadt. Now, again, I said that was a Jesuit university, so his education was at the hands of the Jesuits, and his employers were basically Jesuits. He was not clergy himself. He is a layman. He was a lay professor employed at a Catholic Jesuit-run university, which I guess sort of brings up the question, you know, for anybody who may not be initiated to that, who are the Jesuits? Okay, why are they so important?
Yes.
The Jesuits, was founded in Spain in the 16th century by a fellow by the name of a former Spanish soldier and nobleman, the name of Ignatius Loyola, Ignacio Loyola. Yeah, you've probably heard of him because half the Jesuit schools that exist in the U.S.
That's right.
Are named after him. Anything with Loyola, you just discovered that.
That's right.
Now, the interesting thing about Ignatius Loyola is that early on in his life, before he entered the church and before he became the founder of this religious order, the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, is that he was either a member of or in some way associated with a group I just mentioned, the Spanish Illuminati, the Alumbrados. And that was a group that was suppressed as heretical by the church. But early on in his kind of spiritual quest, he was a member of some earlier Illuminati group.
Yeah.
Which has led some to argue that, well, that can't be coincidental, that, you know, Loyola was connected to some sort of Illuminati, and then he founds the Jesuit order, that founds this university that employs Adam Weishaupt, and then a century or so later, he forms his own society, and, oh, they're called the Illuminati as well. Well, yeah, it could be, but again, I'd caution that Illuminati is a very generic term. But we'll simply note that those things exist. And that's one of the things that I suggest people do in kind of research, is don't immediately jump to conclusions about something.
That's right.
Simply note that these correspondences exist, hang on to that idea, and then wait and see whether other things come up that tend to support a connection or not, whether it just seems to be a one-off, whether it seems to be an accident or coincidence, or whether it's something that's meaningful. But don't immediately import great significance to a single coincidence. Wait and see if there are others in that case. So the Jesuits became a very powerful order within the Catholic Church. In fact, there were some in the Catholic Church itself who argued that they had become too powerful.
Many still say so.
The simplest way to describe them is that the Jesuit order became, in the 1600s and thereon, the kind of Marine Corps of the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah.
They were created specifically in many ways to combat the Protestant Reformation.
And also specifically to be the missionary arm of the church, who, like, when the church came to the New World, they brought the Jesuits with them.
You'll find that the Jesuits were always in wherever the Catholic Church landed, where they formed a beachhead, the Jesuits were there as the shock troops of the Catholic Church.
That's right.
And so the order amassed great power, property, influence. It had its own grand master as a such. So there were some that then later argued that the Jesuits in the more modern era had become the equivalent of what the Knights Templar had been some centuries before.
Absolutely.
A monastic order, an order within the church that had exercised great power and independence, and perhaps partly for that reason was eventually suppressed. And that happened to the Jesuits in the 18th century. Critics in the Vatican argued that the Jesuit order had become too powerful. It had become a kind of church within a church in many ways, and therefore it was for decades suppressed throughout much of the 18th century and into the early 19th century. The order was suppressed. It was eventually restored, but it went through this, and this is one of the things that affected Weishaupt, because when the Jesuit order was suppressed, its control was taken away from the University of Ingolstadt and others. And now Weishaupt found himself without his sort of church superiors above him. I mean, it was still a church university, but the Jesuits were no longer in control.
Yeah, somewhat disenfranchised, so to speak.
Yeah. And so the order is not, you know, the Jesuits are not destroyed. They will return in all of their glory some decades down the road. Now, that's an interesting point to keep in mind, that it's an interesting case that just because an organization is banned in some official sense, that it just goes away, that it just dissipates like mist. Okay, the Jesuits were dethroned. They did not disappear. They would return as an important element within the church. But the 18th century, they've fallen under suspicion, and they have been put on the shelf by the church. And this now arguably gives lay professors at Jesuit universities greater freedom to, well, greater academic freedom. But there is this kind of, what critics would later argue, I mean, and part of the whole mythology of the Bavarian Illuminati is that there are some who argue that, well, no, that this is, again, it's not a coincidence that the Bavarian Illuminati are created by Weishaupt as the Jesuit order is suppressed. And thus some have argued that what he's actually doing is the bidding of the Jesuits.
Yeah.
That the Bavarian Illuminati are a manifestation of the Jesuits in exile. It is the order operating under another name. And that's by no means impossible. But it's one of those things, again, that you can't prove. So let's just note that correspondence and then go on to look and see if we can find we can find other ones. So what we're talking about here are the kind of basic facts of the Illuminati. So we know the name of the guy who founded it. It's Adam Weishaupt. We know the position that he held. We know where he held it. We know the day and the year in which he formed the organization. We know that he certainly had a connection to the Jesuit order, not as a member of it, but as an employee of that order. So what did Weishaupt form this organization for? I mean, wasn't he busy being a professor of canon law? Okay, why is he forming a secret initiatory society? Well, I guess one of the ways, the simplest way to put it is that Weishaupt apparently considered himself a very smart guy. And he thought that there were other smart people around, but he didn't think that most people were. Okay, this is a not unusual pattern. Okay. And the basic idea is that somehow smart people, as however you want to define them, should run the world, and everyone else should just kind of be managed. That's really what so keep in mind there's nothing in any way, not in the slightest way, democratic about the Bavarian Illuminati.
Yeah.
It is a hierarchical, elitist organization. At best, what it aims to do is to replace the existing elite in European society, and in a greater sense, the existing elite throughout the world, with a new elite. An elite of selected, enlightened individuals. So, Weishaupt's idea, roughly, is to create an organization that will forge a new world order. That's, you know, if you want to think about when that term actually begins to come along, that's the idea. And that the ultimate goal of this organization is to sweep aside, or more simply, to destroy the entire existing political and religious order of Europe and the world, and to replace it with a new centralized, rationalized order in the hands of an initiated elite.
That's right.
The illuminated ones.
Yeah. Yeah. Not the average rabble of humanity who would have equal representation in something. But yeah, the hands of the few. And it's fascinating to once again see that. And to see a lot of the roots of where we get this hypothesis and this conspiracy theory that is out there about the New World Order and the bringing about of that, and the Illuminati being in the shadows pulling strings, you know, because there are, once again, a lot of very definite cursory connections, you know, where the colors on the palette kind of bleed together, Doctor, especially once you start looking at, once again, the founding of things in 1776 and, America, things like that. Let's move the conversation to that and to how, especially this illuminated thinking at the time. I mean, we had the French Revolution right at the same time. We had quite a few movements across Europe as well as America when it happened. So how did this spread across the pond? How did it come over here? And did the Illuminati have their fingers, at least the Illuminati as we know them, have their fingers in the American Revolution?
Well, interesting you should mention that, because I think it's in 1790, something 1798, might not have been that late, but you can actually find a mention of the Bavarian Illuminati and Weishaupt in the correspondence of, well, you can find it in the correspondence of George Washington.
Yep.
You can also find that Thomas Jefferson is quite aware of what it is. So, just kind of ponder that for a moment. This is the 18th century. And it means that, news, word of anything to travel from Europe to the Americas is a fairly laborious process. Remember, there's no internet.
Yeah.
there's no rapid movement of information. It meant that you would have to write something down. Okay. Longhand. You'd have to write a letter and mail that letter, entrusting it to the rather treacherous transatlantic system of transport, and get that all the way across. But these things went back and forth. And it's, news did travel, but it did not travel quickly. Ah, indeed it is, 1798. It didn't travel quickly. And for that reason, people very often sort of kept news down to fairly serious business. So the fact that the existence and reputation of the Bavarian Illuminati from its inception, about the time the American Revolution started.
Yeah.
Now we go another 20 years later, the revolution has succeeded, the American Republic has been created, and you now have Washington being asked questions about what he thought was the possible influence of the Bavarian Order, which by this time, as we'll see, is supposedly suppressed.
Once again, though, the idea that at that point, even at that point, there was scuttlebutt that the Illuminati had their fingers in things over here in this country, and that the country was being founded by them and everything else. And George Washington is like, absolutely not. They are nowhere near the Masons in this country. We don't see the Illuminati in our lodges. Like even calls them the contaminated. None of the lodges here are contaminated with their thinking. Because once again, the idea wasn't for a country to be ruled by elites. It was for country of the people, by the people, for the people in theory.
Well, what Washington acknowledges is that he knows the reputation of the Illuminati.
Yep.
And he does acknowledge that Illuminist ideas, that the Illuminati, at least as a doctrine, whatever that might be, has made its way to America. That is, it has its adherents.
Yep.
But that those, as far as he can tell, they have not taken over. And when he's talking about the lodges, he's talking about Masonic lodges.
That's right.
Keep in mind, George Washington is a big-time American Freemason, and that's what he essentially is being asked about.
Yeah.
Have the Illuminati influenced or taken over American Masonry? And that's a valid question.
Absolutely.
Because one of the things that Adam Weishaupt would become, and so he forms the Illuminati in 1776. At that time, he is not a Freemason.
That's right.
But in the following year, he will be initiated as a Freemason, and he will then encourage, in fact, as the head of the order, he will effectively command that all of his little Illuminati join Masonic lodges.
Yeah.
That if you are not a member already, you should join the lodges, and you should do this with a specific purpose in mind of turning those lodges into vehicles of recruitment and influence for our order.
That's right.
In other words, we are going to infiltrate and parasitize Masonic lodges, and under the cover of Masonry, we're then going to pursue our goals. Because one of the things that Weishaupt made very clear from the beginning, he states that we should never should the actual name of our order appear in any public sense.
Yeah.
We should always operate behind something else.
Yeah. And that, I think, is where we really, really get that concept of, because, you know, once again, if you ask any head of a lodge of the Masons, if you ask any head of Knights of Columbus Council, things like that, they will tell you we are not a secret society. We're a society with like maybe a secret password to get through the door, you know, but that's it. That's about as far as the secret goes. You know, we aren't a society that is trying to hide our presence in the world. Like they build huge buildings and put Mason on the front of them.
They advertise
it. They have,
if you look into the, there's usually a signpost outside any inhabited place in the U.S.
Right.
that will tell you
we're
that
here.
There is a Masonic lodge in town.
That's right.
So, no, they don't hide their existence. They clam up right away if you begin to ask them anything happens internally.
Yeah.
That's what you have to be initiated.
Absolutely.
To know. So Weishaupt's idea is that the Illuminati order is to be disguised in its outward operations. It never does anything as the Illuminati. It will always do something as something. Another thing he also notes that in addition to using the existing system of Masonic lodges to grow and perpetuate our movement, the other thing he argues you should infiltrate are reading societies and effectively book clubs.
Mm. Yeah,
because this you know, educated people in the 18th century would get together and they would discuss books and philosophical ideas, and these so-called reading societies. I mean, you find those if you look into the context of the American Revolution or French Revolution, reading societies, which were basically political discussion groups, and which could then easily become conspiratorial organizations. Were in an important way in which ideas were sort of spread and as a sort of system of discussion, intellectual inquiry, political agitation. But those already existed. So Weishaupt is arguing you need to get into those as well,
yeah.
and thus take them over,
yep.
turn them in a means that – you know what all this begins to sound vaguely like?
The emperor?
The 20th century – Communist Party, doesn't it?
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like the emperor.
Front groups. Notice how the idea that there would be communist front groups.
Absolutely.
Nobody, it doesn't say commie on the front of it, but yeah. yes, these would be. And yes, those things actually existed. The Communist Party did infiltrate existing groups.
Yep.
And then turn them to the party's purpose.
Absolutely.
Now, so let's hang on to that idea, see whether or not that's another one of those things that's an interesting coincidence,
yeah.
or is it evidence of something else?
Yeah, because they did the same thing with Rosicrucian societies, which pre-existed the Illuminati. The same edict was the same way, like go join Rosicrucian societies and see who is amenable to the teaching and bring them into the fold.
Right. And you learn something, but they never tell you what you're going to learn.
Yeah,
the whole thing with the Rosicrucians was that they would advertise that, oh, this is this really cool group, and if you learn it, you'll get the secrets of the universe or all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So, but what specifically are you going to learn? Well, you'd have to join, and then you'll find out. But it's really important, and it's really cool stuff. And yeah, I think there's another episode in the Secret Society
of
the Rosicrucians where I just basically argue that they're about everything and nothing. I mean, Rosicrucianism is whatever you want it to be because it's never defined.
That's right. Yeah.
It's the wisdom of the ages. And once you get in here, then you'll figure out what that is.
Yeah.
Or something.
It is very individual to the Rosicrucian themselves, much like alchemy is to the alchemist.
Yes, it's what you want it to be. So,
yeah.
So Weishaupt has this, the thing about Weishaupt is that he is, at the very least, an excellent political conspirator. He knows how to organize. You know, you operate under a number of different organizations.
Yeah.
Why does he single out the Freemasons? Well, he knows that they already exist in Masonic lodges throughout Germany and Europe were, you know, they were in fashion. They were in vogue at that time.
Yep.
And he knows the fact that, you know, because they're so common, most people don't think much of them. I mean, they don't tend to attract a lot of attention. So that's exactly what we want. We don't want to create something new. We simply want to infiltrate and turn to our purposes something that already exists. The other thing about them is that they attracted the right sort of people. So it comes back to the question of who did Weishaupt want as members of his new order? He didn't want peasants. He didn't want working men. He didn't want commoners at all. What he wanted were people who already possessed education, wealth, and above all, influence. He wanted to recruit influential people.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, in the same way, Masonic lodges in the 18th century, even today, tend to attract people who are either middle class or aspirant middle class. You tend not to find, again, farmers or working men playing important roles in Masonry, partly because it was expensive to be a member.
That's right.
Now, just, you know, get one of those, you know, get a catalog of Masonic regalia. That stuff's expensive. There's all kinds of things that you have to buy.
Yep.
So the price of membership in the order was fairly hefty, and there's a reason for that. There is a practical reason, because expense keeps out the riffraff. You didn't want anyone in your organization who couldn't afford to be a member, because you're, again, you know, if you looked at Masonic lodges in most American towns, you would tend to find that they were overwhelmingly populated by professionals and businessmen. That's who belonged to them. And therefore, in many ways, they constituted already the sort of local elite. And so it's just, it's one of the things about elites. They always like to become more elite.
Yeah, right.
They can't become elite enough, apparently.
It's the next level of elite.
It's the next level of elite. Just sell them that there's another level of elite and they'll go for it.
Yeah.
So what Weishaupt was doing is exactly that. So if you look at we've got there's a guy by the name of Terry Melanson. And anybody who's really interested in digging into this deeper and getting names attached to it, if you find Terry Melanson's Order of Perfectibilists, a book, which is really just a kind of encyclopedia of the known members of the Bavarian Illuminati, that is, people who acknowledged that they were members of this group. And again, what you find are not common people. You don't find peasants and working men. You don't find, you know, you don't find petty merchants. What you find in great abundance are members of the nobility.
Mm.
There are princes and dukes who join the Illuminati. You find a high ranking, both Protestant and even in some cases Catholic clergy who become part of this.
That's right.
You find people who are lawyers, courtiers, you know, if not the royals themselves, the people who serve the royal. You find people who have wealth and importance. They're already part of the existing elite.
Yeah.
So think about this for a minute. Weishaupt's declared goal is to create a new order that will sweep aside all existing political and social order. Which means that if you're a prince, or I don't know, let's take it down. If you're a count in Germany who joins the Illuminati, well, you've just joined a group whose declared intention is to obliterate everything that you currently are.
That's right. Yeah. Obliterate your title, your land, everything.
Nobility.
Yeah.
So why would you do that? Why would you, as a nobleman, join a group which seeks to annihilate nobility? Well, because it offers you something else. It offers you the idea of a more exalted nobility.
Mm.
A nobility in some ways of merit as opposed to birth. You know, because generally, you know, and you can find the same thing again if you were to look in the 20th century of people who come from. Well, here's one of the kind of phenomena that you can find. Capitalist communists.
Yeah.
People who are, in fact, very successful in business or, in fact, come from well-established business. You know, people who were born with silver spoons in their mouth.
Yep.
Who nonetheless become ardent communists. And it's the same sort of thing. They view that by casting aside the privilege of birth and position they had previously and embracing this new nobility of communism, that they will rise in some way to an even more exalted level.
Yes.
But people will do that if they think it's something which is grander than what they already have.
Yeah. And a prime example of that in modern society is I love his music. I Roger Waters, the lead singer from Pink Floyd. And an ardent communist. I believe his parents were as well, if I'm not mistaken, but he also came from a family of means. And even now, you know, touring the world, things like that, like, hey, he owns that sound system. He's not renting it, you know?
It's rich. Well, it's one of the things you often find if you look at revolutionary leaders, communist or otherwise, Lenin. Was a member of the hereditary Russian nobility. His whole family was. His father got the family. I mean, they weren't particularly high, but yes, he was a nobleman within the Russian Empire. Leon Trotsky, who will become another important communist, came from his father was a well-to-do businessman. And on his mother's side, he had millionaire uncles. So he comes from wealthy, well-connected, capitalist, entrepreneurial families who nonetheless would often support his revolutionary activities. There's one of the things that could sometimes be put to that is that being, you know, I was not born into a plutocratic family, so I don't know. I do not speak from experience.
That's right.
But it seems apparent that there are people who are born into, let's say, a wealthy family, whether it's an aristocratic family or whether it's a kind of economically aristocratic family. You know, you're born of Vanderbilt, for instance. And one of the things that you can arguably realize from that position is how false and arbitrary that is.
Mm.
I mean, sure. One of the things of being inside the elite, of being a in many ways a kind of hereditary member of it, is that you can simply perceive that it's all just, you know, nonsense in a way. That the people in this are not particularly deserving of the wealth that they have. They inherited it, or they're just, you know, syphilitic fools or whatever you want to have them. And then it's one of the things I think that could convince someone that this is not legitimate and that it must be replaced with something which is more legitimate.
Yeah.
I mean, put it this way. Who is in a better position to know the depravity of the rich than the rich?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, with that in mind, especially bridging the gap once again between the founding of the Illuminati, what was going on socioeconomically at the time, things like that, that really kind of birthed that, and philosophically all at the same time, because once again, all three of those were high tension roiling to the top of the pot at that point in time, in numerous countries across Europe and here in America. So to see that happen and to see kind of the arc of where things have come today, How do we get to the point of and granted, even as a former Roman Catholic seminarian, as a fourth degree Knight of Columbus, and as a student of history, I can see how when you start looking at the Jesuits running the university that Weishaupt taught at and everything else, the fact that they infiltrated so many different, not just rungs of society above themselves, but also the secret societies that they belong to. I can see how there is that overarching conspiracy of did Weishaupt's hopeful new world order ever take seed in today?
Well, so let's look at a couple of things. So we know that it was founded in 1776. It grew, I think Melanson is probably documented in his book, several hundred members. And you can notice that these are, you know, these are not the rank and file of society. These are people from the existing 18th century elite, most prevalently in Germany, in Austria, but also in France and the Netherlands, even as far off as Russia. Italy became an important area for recruitment as well. Doesn't seem to make much inroads into Britain or into the kind of Anglophone world. But, you know, again, as we note in the in that later correspondence by George Washington, Washington was aware of it, and he disapproved of it. So he was, he thought that the Illuminati were bad, and that they were a corrupting influence. Now, opposed to that, however, Thomas Jefferson thought that Weishaupt, and he describes him in one thing as a philanthropist. He thought that Weishaupt was actually a pretty cool guy. So here you have two of the key figures in the American Revolution, Washington, who was aware of the Illuminati and disapproves of them, who views them as a, I think he at one point uses the term pernicious.
Yeah. Okay.
These guys are bad. They're evil. Whereas Jefferson thought, no, you know, I think their aspirations are, you know, he doesn't say he's one of them, but he's sympathetic.
Sure.
Yeah. He thinks that their goal was fairly lofty, and that Weishaupt is, you know, a kind of philanthropic character. So that just shows you how in America, among the American Revolutionary elite, the Illuminati were known, their existence was acknowledged, but in the case of Washington and Jefferson, you find two completely different views of them, one negative, one positive.
Yeah.
So other than recruiting a lot of people into his, you know, or at least some hundreds, maybe, you know, the number of total number may have been a couple of thousand. That's probably not exceeding it. It might have been slightly more than that. That's not a lot. You know, you would assume, let's assume that in its known time span, which is basically about 10 years, from the mid-1770s to the mid-1780s, that legally is as long as the whole organization functioned visibly, that it managed to enroll about 2,000 people. Now, keep in mind, those are 2,000 people who are influential. It's not how many people you have. It is the
people who you have.
So Weishaupt's goal of trying to recruit the existing elite as members of a new elite did pretty well within the space of a decade. Recruitment was selective. He wanted certain people, didn't want others. You've now got this organization that spreads throughout much of Central Europe, but it then attracts the attention of the Bavarian royal authorities, and they don't like it. Because, you know, after all, there's this organization being run by some sort of crazy professor at a defrocked Jesuit university who's planning on creating, you know, they have some sort of idea they're going to, you know, get rid of existing orders. Well, we're the existing order. We don't like that. So the Bavarian crown, I think first in 1784, 1785, issued an edict banning the organization. And one of the things that fueled this, of course, is that they actually got a hold of Illuminati things that Weishaupt had written that were proclaiming their subversive goals. All of this fell into the hands of the Bavarian authorities. And there are different stories as to how that happened. There's a story which is that, you know, there was an Illuminati courier who was struck by lightning and these things were then found on his dead body. I don't think that ever happened. More than likely what happened with this, there was a member of the Illuminati close in the higher levels, a fellow by the name of Baron Knigge. Baron. And Knigge had an issue with Weishaupt. He thought that Weishaupt was too dictatorial. Now, Knigge thought that the upper ranks of the Illuminati, things ought to be, well, you know, more collective leadership.
Hmm.
And he thought that Weishaupt was just sort of running this whole thing for himself. And what I would bet happened, it's Knigge who went to the Bavarian authorities and revealed the organization. But there's also a third possibility, and that, well, there always is, that Weishaupt organized this himself. Now, why? Why would Weishaupt countenance the exposure and banning of his own organization? Well, for PR.
Sure.
Because by being banned, because the Bavarian government then turned around and did what? They'd gotten these Illuminati manifestos, and then they published them so that the public could see just how pernicious this organization was. Now, you think about it. On the one hand, you've just got the government to publish your own propaganda against the government and to disseminate it without any cost to you.
Yeah.
That's the way in which you create the kind of... So personally, my suspicion, this is not a fact, this is just me speculating, is that Weishaupt, in one way or the other, effectively conspired in the outing and banning of his own order as a way of promoting it and mythologizing it.
Yes.
Because an order which had been banned therefore becomes even more secretive and desirable than one which operates openly.
Yeah.
Now, the other interesting thing is that the Bavarian government just didn't do this once. They ban the Illuminati order in Bavaria 4 times.
That's right.
In the course. Now, why do you do that? Why do you ban the same organization 4 times? Well, because apparently the first 3 times it didn't work. They're still there.
Yeah.
So what we know from that is that the Bavarian government discovered the Illuminati, published their insidious manifestos as they saw it, and then on 4 different occasions had to ban this organization because it was still functioning. They never, they're banning it doesn't destroy anything.
And, you know, I mean, I'm a comic book fan, Richard. And what's funny is how much comic book is pulled from history. And when you start looking at the concept of Hydra, from the Red Skull in Captain America, and the idea of like when you cut one head off, 2 more remain, like 2 more come back, like you'll never get rid of Hydra is kind of the idea. Like, okay, great. You got rid of us in public. We've gone underground now. And I think that's where a lot of people really think that the Illuminati is now. And even now talking about it, it almost sounds like that was their intent and purpose, was to get up a good number of people of influence who have a different mindset, set off the fire, and then kind of abandon it in public, but keep it going within their familial line, keep it going within their business line, things like that.
It just goes dark.
Yeah.
That's what you have. But, you know, so the idea, for instance, that you can, you know, I once saw somebody said that, well, the Bavarian government banned it and the whole organization was destroyed. No, they didn't arrest anybody, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Weishaupt, where does he go? He goes to the neighboring principality of Gotha, where the prince is a member of the Illuminati, and gives him sanctuary. And Weishaupt lives until what? 1830, 1833.
Yeah.
He'll live for decades, and he continues his correspondence with all of his Illuminati throughout Europe. The organization is never destroyed. There's no mass purge. It just dissipates, and it goes dark. I mean, technically, it no longer exists, but it still exists. And remember, it's never supposed to operate under its own name.
That's right.
By the way, this raises the interesting question. Remember, Illuminati is a kind of generic term. Yeah. What is the actual name of the order?
Yeah.
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 Is it?
Once again, it's one of those that he really did set up for his own point of infamy in this kind of way in history, as well as just that mythological status of, yes, once you see how this went down, you can completely see how the conspiracy theory of the Illuminati is involved with everything from the Catholic Church and how it runs with the Jesuits to, you know, the American government here in the United States, to familial lines in Europe, to the movie industry and rock and roll and everything. Well, like that once again is the whole idea, Doctor, that secret symbology is being shown everywhere in the Super Bowl, everywhere.
They existed visibly, and then they existed invisibly. And there's a beginning, but there's no actual end. There's no actual thing where you can say that you took this thing and you drove a stake through his heart and it was destroyed. No, that never happened. Now, that does not mean you can't necessarily follow that because the Illuminati lived on after it was legally banned in Bavaria, but not really anywhere else, that it then continued to metastasize and become ever larger and more influential.
Yeah.
It could have just, you know, the other argument is that, well, everybody just got bored with it and eventually they just died out. You know, it was no longer cool after a while and it just petered away and nobody talked about it. And it just ceased to exist when the existing members died off and went from there. That could have happened. But we don't know. And this is why and I think this is what Weishaupt in some ways deliberately did. He turned his organization into a myth, into a kind of ghost organization that was still there, operating in different forms, in different places, under different names. Certainly there were people later on who felt that they were inspired by it. There were a whole many number of groups that would come up in the aftermath of the French Revolution. There was a group that wanted to restore the more radical, you know, the French Revolution went through a series of phases and it went through a very radical phase. Then those people got their heads chopped off and it eventually went into a somewhat more less radical phase that then eventually leads us up to the de-radical phase of Napoleon. But in the interim of that, again, in the 1790s, I think there was a group called the Conspiracy of Equals. And their idea was they were dissatisfied French radicals who wanted to go back, reignite the Jacobin Revolution of Robespierre, you know, that would lead to the whole de-Christianization of France, the cult of reason, and chopping off a lot more heads. That conspiracy was rather quickly suppressed. But one of the things that they actually acknowledged was that they were inspired by the ideas of Adam Weishaupt and the Illuminati. They saw that they were sort of carrying on that work. So, you know, the legend continued in that respect.
Interesting.
There's another thing I wanted to mention was that in terms of what I think of Weishaupt's sort of political acumen or organizational acumen was the Illuminati's approach towards women. And he had, then there was a view there. So keep in mind, we're talking about the 18th century. And in the 18th century, well, it was indeed, you know, it was a man's world, quite literally. Yeah. Women had very little, even in countries such as France or Bavaria, their economic rights were limited. They had no political rights. Of course, neither did most people. So one of the things that Weishaupt recognized is that women as a group, especially women from elite families, women with some education, had a chip on their shoulder. They were disenfranchised. He knew that there were lots of women from wealthy backgrounds, educated backgrounds, who resented their inferior situation.
Mm.
And what Weishaupt noted is that wherever you find that there's a beef, wherever you find a group of people who have resentment over something, who feel that they are persecuted, discriminated against, or left out and unappreciated, that is something you must exploit. So Weishaupt's idea is that the order should cater to the resentment of educated women over their lack of power. And it should promise them equality. You know, in the new order to come, that women will have equal rights with men. All of the disadvantages you currently suffer will be swept aside.
Yeah.
Now, he was never entirely serious about that, because within the ranks of the Illuminati, there are not women. He had no intention of sharing power with them. They would never have that. But that's what it was that you would promise. The whole goal is to exploit the resentment. And this was for a simple reason. He realized that there was no better way to influence men than through women. That women did have influence over their husbands, over their sons, over their brother, whatever it might be. And to get women on our side, especially women in influential families, was a way of gaining a new ally. And to do that, we will promise them everything. We will deliver very little. And of course, there are those who argue that that extends into modern times. But it also comes into this idea that while you can exploit resentments politically, you never want to satisfy those resentments.
Yeah.
You never want to remove the source of it, because to do that then removes your ability to manipulate.
Yeah.
Those people.
Yeah. You're eating the carrot on the end of the stick at that point. You have nothing to motivate now.
Promise that the future holds the liberation. But you must never actually give that, thereby losing your power over them. And if nothing else, I'd argue this. Adam Weishaupt, in his own particular, Jesuit-trained career, really set the model for many of the things that were going to continue into the 19th, into the 20th, and to the 21st centuries. And his plan is a pretty good one. It has within it a kind of, you can argue, is either brilliant or it's diabolical or it's both of those. But nevertheless, this is not something which is an ill-considered, impossible idea. It's a plan which has a disturbing amount of logic to it, a very cynical logic, a very manipulative one, but one that if you look in terms of the course of modern political and social development. I don't know. Think of it this way. Would Adam Weishaupt be terribly upset with anything that he found today? Would he assume that his work had achieved? Had his seed he planted in Bavaria in 1776, had it grown and influenced the world?
That I think is really a lot of the question here, because once again, whether or not the Illuminati as it existed with Adam Weishaupt and the idea behind it, whether or not that exists in modern society in that kind of way, I don't truly think so. I'm one of those that thinks, the actual lineage of people just went away. But I think there is still a lot of remnant mentality of that a lot of those teachings, yes, did infiltrate other things that did continue, that did move forward, even whenever you look at some of the work of Manly P. Hall and stuff like that with the Masons, there is some of that, kind of elitist tone to it. In that kind of way, people who don't belong, stuff like that. And it's fascinating to see that. Now, I don't think that they control the Masons in any way, shape or form. Because once again, I don't think that the Illuminati as we know it, as it traditionally existed, exists anymore.
No, I wouldn't. And then again, of course, there are lots of questions here.
Sure.
We don't really know exactly what the order was.
Yeah.
We don't know exactly how many people ever belonged to it. But the one thing is that, and I can mention, the conspiracy of equals in late revolutionary France, but there were there were people who into the 19th century acknowledged being inspired by the Bavarian Illuminati.
Absolutely.
So it's mythology. It's the basic concept of this idea, particularly the idea of sweeping aside existing order and replacing it with a new one, was one that continued. And there's a progression of this inspiration that eventually leads up to things like the League of the Just in Germany, in France, by the time we get to the middle of the 19th century. And the people who come out of that is Karl Marx.
Yep.
Yeah. Karl Marx has in his background a membership in groups which acknowledged inspiration from the Illuminati. And again, in Marxism, you also have fundamentally the appeal to the resentment of the working class. You know, a group of people that really didn't exist back in Weishaupt's day. In the 1780s, industrialization was just beginning. By the time we get to 1848, in the era of the Communist Manifesto, well, industrialism is in full bloom, and now you've got this whole creation of this vast, you know, largely disenfranchised economic class.
Yeah.
The proletariat. Something else that can now, whose resentment and aspirations can be focused for a revolutionary cause. And that's very much sort of following in Weishaupt's model. I mean, I think Adam Weishaupt been alive at that time, he would have focused upon exactly that group of people. And again, this has nothing to do, this is simply the exploitation of the frustrations of the lower class as a means of toppling the existing order to simply replace it with another elite. And if you go down the road further, if you get into Vladimir Lenin in the early 20th century and his whole theory of the party and his vision of a revolutionary society, again, there's nothing democratic about it. Lenin's whole concept in the creation of what would become the Bolshevik and later the Communist Party was the creation of a revolutionary vanguard. So one of the big differences in the early revolutionary movement, the difference, let's say, between Lenin and his Bolsheviks and the much larger Mensheviks, because we can they're all Marxists. Okay, they all believe that the future belongs to the working class. But what the Mensheviks roughly wanted to do was to organize a mass labor party. They wanted to get all the workers organized into a political party that would then vote socialism into existence. Lenin argued that that was fundamentally sort of stupid and time consuming. That instead, the party should consist of a small, dedicated, revolutionary elite. People who were nothing but revolutionaries, who dedicated themselves to the cause, who existed under a firm, centralized leadership. He was at the top. He gave all the orders. The party carried them out. Yep. And his argument is you don't need a huge party to do that. You just need this dedicated revolutionary elite. And this is why eventually when the Bolsheviks come to power, that's what you get. All of the masses under the control of the party.
Yeah.
And that, too, is, I think, very much a kind of Weishauptian way of looking at things.
Well, even whenever you look at the idea, and this takes it to a horrible, horrible degree, Doctor, but even whenever you look at the terrorist concept of a cell and the idea of, like, you have an end directive, but we're not giving you every order to hit that end directive. Everything else in between is whatever you need to do in your local area to make that happen, you know? And the idea is that if one cell goes down, it doesn't take down the whole network, you know? The other cells operate independently toward the mutual objective, you know? And they're very much in the same kind of way, where once again, do we know whether or not ever whether or not a terrorist network is actually destroyed, or did they just go dark, you know, very much in the same way that we're talking about the Illuminati right now. Can we guarantee the fact that they didn't hit end objective and take over world governments in a dark shadows in the back of a boardroom kind of way? Well, I guess technically no.
Well, yeah, it brings me back to another sort of, you know, another Leninist aphorism, okay?
Sure.
So it was one of the other things that Lenin said, and this is important. He said, flexibility in means, inflexibility in goal.
Yeah.
So you have a goal in mind. There's a thing you want to achieve. And what you want to achieve is, well, power. You want to take over the state. You want to take power. How do you do that? Any way you can. Flexibility in means. It's like water always finding a way through.
Yeah.
That you follow that, you take advantage of every means you can, never forgetting that your ultimate goal is power. And whatever gets you there is sanctified by that purpose. You no longer have to worry about whether you're doing. See, that's something else, the idea that if you're serving a higher goal, you can do any nasty thing in the service of that, and it is immediately forgiven.
Yeah,
it is as if the church forgives it.
Yeah, the ends justifies the means.
In the cause of the church will forgive you for that.
Yeah.
And therefore, whatever you do, how many ever millions you have to kill in order to achieve your goal is sanctified by the loftiness of what that goal is.
Mm. Yeah. And you know, once again, to know that the hypothesis of and the conspiracy theories of Illuminati go so thick, so deep, like we could talk for hours on it, Doctor. It's fascinating. And even whenever you look at, once again, its permeation into modern society, it took, I would say, and I wouldn't even say that technically the damage of Dan Brown has been undone yet. because the whole Da Vinci Code series brought the Illuminati right back into the public eye and into much, much more of a public eye than just a conspiracist's eye or a historian's eye. And mainly because of the book, you know, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, things like that, which the data of which was utterly planted, falsified, all kinds of things.
Well, so, yeah, you got this whole sort of,
but it really shows how even having proven the fact that the data of that was planted, people will still fully accept the fact that all of it is real.
Yes, because the story is too good for it not to be real.
No, it's fantastic. It's an amazing story.
Bagent and Lincoln and Lee, okay, the three guys who eventually came up with Holy Blood, the Holy Grail, the book, the sort of scholarly book that Dan Brown then took and turned into the Da Vinci Code, a work of fiction.
That's right.
So the book that he... I would argue that he plagiarized. Okay.
Close to.
They tried suing him on that. Yep. They couldn't do it because he never said, you know, they were presenting this as fact. He was presenting. He just says, I just took the story you told and turned it into a better story.
Yes.
That's what he did. You know, that was apparently fair game. But they got this whole idea from this French leader of a secret society formed in the 1950s called Pierre Plantard. Okay. So they bought Plantard's story that there was this whole secret organization, the Priory of Zion, which had been guarding the holy bloodline of Jesus and Mary back from time immemorial. And this was just, you know, this was Pierre Plantard was a con man. That's, if you look at his career, he essentially came up with, he was a kind of religious con artist. And that's, he may have borrowed certain things that might have been, he just sort of appropriated. They came up with this whole dossier of stuff. You would plant documents in archives. And this, by the way, is one of the things that people never suspect could happen.
Yeah.
Because you'll often hear about the idea of documents are missing in archives. And that, by the way, happens. Stuff does get stolen out of archives. That's one of the reasons why if you go to archives, they're often very, very picky about, you know, bringing in bags because people steal stuff. But the one thing that they're not really looking out for is people bringing stuff in and planting it in the archives.
That's right.
That has happened. That is, there are cases where that has occurred. And if there are a few cases that you found, the one thing you can be reasonably certain of, there are more cases that you have not found. So just because something is stuck in an archive or shows up in a file, you have to be very careful with these type of things. So Plantard was a fraud. The various, you know, whether his Priory of Zion in itself was something he just invented or an idea that he borrowed, actually that idea had been around previously, he was the one who packaged this whole thing. And that was the package that Bajan and Lee and Lincoln bought. They liked the story. They wrote it up in this kind of at least quasi, scholarly format. It was supposed to be true. And Brown saw the dramatic potential in this and turned it into a highly popular fictionalized version, which, again, a lot of people took as true because it was such a good story. And it simply goes from there. But it's an interesting case of where things come, you know, you've got an historical basis for something. Something really existed. And then that gets kind of elaborated and things get added to it. And then it becomes part of popular culture. And then the popular culture version feeds back into this loop.
Yeah.
And it has to support itself.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that I love about this show, Doctor, is the chance to help demystify these things for people, because even real researchers can get so entirely sidetracked when something hits radar. And if they're not careful, if people aren't careful to understand historic meanings behind things, the historic connection behind things, surely acknowledge the historic connection behind things. But if that's all that there is the cursory connection, then as you said earlier with the Jesuits and the Illuminati, well, we should probably leave it at that cursory connection, you know, and instead of trying to build the bridge between it and make something that is not there. You know, yeah, and truly
don't
manifest
the conclusion.
That. Yeah.
Okay, one of the things we like to have, you know, we want to turn things into a story. When you turn things into a story, you want an ending. Okay. you want to, the movie has to have an ending. Sure. There has to be an arc in this type of thing. So I think one of the problems, you're always trying to take history and turn it into fiction. That's what you're doing. You're trying to turn it into a screenplay which has character arcs and which is a story arc. And reality just doesn't work that way. Okay, reality is not, as far as I can tell, a screenplay. History isn't a screenplay. And what you have are things that come into being and then just sort of, you know, like the Bavarian Illuminati, kind of gradually seem to disappear without actually disappearing. But there's no conclusion to that. We don't find out how it ends because it's a story which is always evolving.
Yeah.
So we like stories that have conclusions, that have answers, that have clear sort of heroes and villains to them. Reality doesn't quite conform to that. So there's always this struggle, I think, between the uncertain reality that we live in and the constant certainty myth that we try to create out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we talk about it regularly on the show, especially whenever it comes to research into UFO, UAP, paranormal, cryptid, things like that. That want of confirmation, married with the confirmation bias because of belief, can be so difficult to overcome. It can be so difficult to get past. And even whenever you're talking about topics like this, even whenever you're talking about topics like the Illuminati, people can consider themselves so learned from online learning that looking at the actual historical connections of things and seeing the actual academic connections, which once again are cursory, they're there, but is it a infiltration kind of way like that? Not necessarily, you know, not so much as the story has told us.
It's not a conclusive. There are things that are suggestive.
Yeah.
So, again, if you look at Lenin's political philosophy, if you look at the whole sort of idea of communism, which was what? The creation, you know, what did communism aspire to? It included the creation of a one world socialist republic that would sweep aside all other, you know, would eradicate religion, all other forms of government, social classes, and create a new utopia under the guidance of an enlightened elite, the party. Well, that just sounds an awful lot like what Weisshoff was talking about in the context of the 18th century. And I would certain that in some way there was a direct or indirect inspiration between those. But the question is, was Lenin's Bolshevism, is 20th century communism a direct descendant of the Bavarian Illuminati? That is, was it the evolution of an idea that continued to morph and grow over those decades? Or is it simply two different people in two different periods arriving at the same conclusions?
Yeah.
Did Lenin simply analyze the situation in the early 20th century and just come to the same sort of conclusions that Weisshoff did? Because those were sort of, you know, if you want to take control, that's how you would do it.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And it's fascinating history to get into, and just something that is so meaty. It's amazing what you do with it and the way that you explain it, Richard. Where can people go to watch the series, Secret Societies? Where can they go to get your books? Where can they go to keep up with all of your research and your work?
Well, let's see. If you're interested in the Great Courses series, the simplest thing to do would be to go to the Great Courses, go to their website. They have hundreds and hundreds of courses. I'm not going to do a whole ad thing for them.
No.
So, but there's a lot more there than just mine. But if you're looking there, you can find The Real History of Secret Societies, Crimes of the Centuries, which is another shorter series I did, Secrets of the Occult. I am currently working on a series for them called Great Villains of History, which will hopefully be out maybe probably within about a year, I think, maybe later next year.
Great.
The other place you can find those, if you have a subscription to Amazon Prime and you go through and look through it, there is a great courses series selection which are there. I'm pretty sure Secrets of the Occult, I know that is up, because I just saw an ad for it on Prime the other, you know, is one of the things available. But if you look through those, I think that sometimes they'll show up for free. Sometimes you would have to have a subscription. But if you have Prime, you have access to most of my stuff. In terms of books, well, there's, you know, Aleister Crowley, you know, Secret Agent 666, so a book on Crowley. There's Wall Street and the Russian Revolution. There's also my biography of Sidney Reilly, which I think is out of print currently, but copies are still available. Trust No One. That's there as well.
Yep.
What else I'm working on? I'm working on, well, a number of different projects. But the one which probably I'd like to see come out at some point is a thing called Flying Saucers and Secret Agents. Okay, I don't know.
Bring
flying saucers into this. What that's about is, I put it this way, one of the things that for years I kind of studiously avoided, I would always step out of the room, so to speak, when it came up, was anything dealing with UFOs. And that was just because
I get that.
It was just a black hole I didn't want to jump into.
It's a big hole.
It's a big hole and it's bottomless, but I became intrigued just with, I became very interested in this, in a fellow who's an early sort of proponent of saucers and space intel, a fellow by the name of George Hunt Williamson.
Okay.
And I became intrigued by Williamson because I realized that one, I actually met him once. but under his second name. So at some point, he becomes a different person in the middle of his life. And I was kind of like, okay, those people are the same. Okay, this is the same guy. And I became intrigued by him. And when I looked at Williamson's career, what jumped out at me was what appeared to be his connections to military and intelligence agencies. And that was kind of, okay, you know, there are people who might argue that I'm always spy happy and I'm always trying to find spies everywhere. Well, it's because there are a lot of them. Yeah. Sometimes you're right. But Williamson, you know, Williamson's whole career, the more I looked at it, looked like a psyop.
Hmm.
And then I went back, and that sort of got, well, I go back and look through sort of particularly the sort of early history of the whole sort of saucer UFO, you know, particularly in the 50s and 60s, when you developed a lot of things that, for lack of a better name, could be called saucer cults.
Sure.
You know, the Space Brothers are coming.
Yep.
They're like angels. They're going to save us. They're bringing us some sort of higher wisdom. All hail the Space Brothers. And again, some of those just look like cults, which isn't that unusual, but there's an awful lot of interesting case of military, intelligence, aerospace people always seem to be running around in this.
Yeah.
And while I would not, my premise is not the entire UFO, or if you prefer, UAP phenomenon is a psyop, I'm pretty firmly convinced that a lot of it is. I don't know who's psyop. I'm not necessarily sure what the purpose might be. And a kind of key tip off for me was that I came across this, you know, it's on the CIA website. You can, you know, they're telling you. It's a memo from 1952. And it was in the aftermath of a bunch of UFO sightings over Washington, D.C., which freaked a lot of people out. And it's a meeting between the military and the CIA and I think Walter Bedell Smith, who was the director of Central Intelligence at the time. And they're basically saying that, well, most of these things can be explained, but some of them can't. And we don't really know what those are. And one of their questions, of course, was, could this all be some sort of psychological operation by the Russians? How timely this is. Could this be some sort of weird Russian meddling to undermine the American people's faith in their military and government officials? And so they think, well, you know, it could be. And then the director of Central Intelligence pipes up and he goes, and what use could this possibly be in our psychological warfare program?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was kind of interesting because, one, the director of Central Intelligence had just said that apparently they have a psychological warfare program.
That's right.
aimed at the American populace and that maybe this whole saucer thing might have a role in it.
Yeah.
So, you know, once people get an idea in their head, they usually begin working on that. So flying saucers and secret agents, which I would like to turn into a limited series on Netflix or something else. Any producers out there interested in that, get a hold of me. But what should also be done as a book is probably the project that I'm sort of most attached to at the present time. But by no means the only one. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's one of those we literally just did an episode on Project Bluebeam and the idea of, sure, it's a conspiracy theory that's out there. However, whenever you start looking at things like the Brookings Institute and what they said about, you know, what would happen if among space travel, we found out about an alien species, should we tell the public? And they're like, absolutely not. It would sow panic, you know? So, like, and that was, I want to say, 1949, 1951, something like that, that the Brookings Institute report came out, the first one that said, like, yeah, we should not tell the public if we were to make contact with an alien species. So, yeah, the fact that our government has possibly known about this kind of stuff, or is even using things as a psychological plant to litmus test people, what have you. Never forget, folks, there is zero law that prevents the government from experimenting on the populace.
Oh, that's
zero, yeah. Zero don't law, and that's as seedy as you can get.
Worry about what the humans are doing to
exactly.
You. That's where the threat comes from.
Exactly. Thank you. From a professor's mouth, folks. Not just from your host. but seriously, it's kind of frightening to know that we have all kinds of laws in place, but there is zero. We even have laws against subliminal messages because we know they work. But there's no law that says that they can't, like, experiment over your heads or with your electronics or with anything, with news messages. There's no law that prevents them from doing that. And it's pretty fascinating. There was the Smith-Mundt Act for a while, but that got stricken down in 2012. So even the idea that now the federal government can literally put propaganda into the news is pretty frightening, you know? So, Professor, well, it's always
should have great. Suspected that years ago.
We should have. There you go.
What?
So, thank you so much for your time. It's always a pleasure speaking
well, thanks
with
for
you.
Having me
on. It's yeah. Always awesome. Once again, greatly appreciate it. Let everybody know where they can go to find all of your courses one last time before we let you go.
For the great course, go to the great courses website. You can find them there. And if you're inclined to buy them, okay, which you know, I do make money off of, but
I have.
Good for me. You can do that. Or if you have a subscription to Amazon Prime and you go down through the, you can find, I think, certainly Real History of Secret Societies and yep. Secrets of the Occult should be there. In terms of books, go to Amazon. That's the place I would start. So
absolutely.
That's where I go.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time. Once again, please do hold the line while we close things out. With
Dude,
the
don't
audience.
Let me mention one more thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Can I do that?
Yeah.
Okay. One of the things, because everybody on Earth apparently is destined to have a podcast. Okay. Which our host realized earlier than many of the rest of us. I'm working with a friend of mine and have developed, you know, it's just the two of us talking about things.
Great.
But it's called Strange as It Seems. And there are, we're working through the kinks of getting audio that doesn't sound terrible, the
sure.
rest of it. But, you know, it's expect no huge visuals. But if you're interested in this type of conversation about a variety of things. Look for Strange as It Seems, which currently some episodes can be found on Spotify. And then hopefully those will be up on YouTube in the near future.
Fantastic. I am so, so happy and proud for you. Congratulations.
It's
a big step, you know, and it can be a scary step as to whether or not you want to make that kind of commitment to do something. But that is a show that I will definitely be tuning into because once again, I love our conversations. They really go places. And whenever you go and I don't think that there is a series from you that I have not subscribed to and just through there and also gone and purchased just to support you because
well, thank
I love your work. It's absolutely amazing. And one of the
thank
things that
much.
We try to focus on this show, we'll go down rabbit holes. We'll hypothesize all day long, even like we did here today. But we will always say this is our educated opinion. This is not fact.
Mm-hmm.
Number one. And number two, we will always encourage people, as you did today, to do their own research and to check this out and to make sure that whenever you're looking at it all, make sure to take it with a grain of salt. You know, understand that that history is written by the victors. Sometimes things get pushed away. And yes, sometimes, even as we just mentioned a minute ago, sometimes things get planted in archives that
yes.
change history for quite a while until we desus that. So once again, appreciate the time. Hold things real quick while we close things out. While you're online checking out the great courses on Amazon, as well as all of the amazing books by Dr. Richard B. Spence right here in our Curious Realm store. make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com/store. That is where you can find all of the books, all of the courses, all of the videos from our guests. You can also visit CuriousRealm.com/video and subscribe to all of the YouTube channels of our guests. While you're there, make sure to get your copy of The Field Observation and Encounter Log by Curious Research. If you are an investigator in the world of UFOs, UAPs, cryptids, if you are out doing paranormal investigation, this is the pocketbook for you. It is quite literally a pocket scientific log that lets you write down information and data from your investigation as it happens in the field, so that come the day that you need to shake hands with science, your data is ready to do so. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation, and without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.